there's one thing that happened that's a bit of an inconvenience, but I think we can work through it. The original outline that I turned in had a copy of the seven laws in it, and I was going to refer to that in my talk, but it's not in your notebook. But those, a copy of the laws is being made right now, and I think before the talk ends, you'll have them.
But this is something a little bit extra that I can give to you. Now, what you have here, for a lot of you probably know, that the seven laws of teaching was revised 1920 by some professors at the University of Illinois. And John Milton Gregory's original work was explicitly Christian. His revised work still had was friendly to Christian thought, but it just wasn't as blatant. The laws that you have on this handout, these are the old ones. Okay? So when you compare them to the new ones, you'll see some of the differences, and I did my best with the pen that I had to try to mark some of those. You can see some of the changes. In the first one, they added or art after truth. The second and third ones were the same. The fourth one, mastered, was changed to learned. And if you read Gregory's book, you understand why. He would be very specific about using the word learned. That wouldn't be accidental or something he hadn't thought about, I suspect. Teaching is arousing and using the pupil's mind to form, not grasp, in it, a desired thought. And it didn't include that other phrase, or to master the desired art. You see art added in 1 and 5 and 6. Learning is thinking into one's own understanding a new idea or truth. And then the test and proof of teaching done, the finishing and fastening process, must be a reviewing, rethinking, re-knowing, reproducing of the knowledge that has been taught. Okay? So hopefully that handout is being prepared for you, and I'm sorry that it's not in the book, or in your notebook. John Milton Gregory said, "No one who will thoroughly master and use them, these seven laws, need fail as a teacher, provided he will also maintain the good order necessary to give them free and undisturbed action." He had a lot of confidence in these laws, and his experience would be one thing that would give him that confidence. Well, who was he? He was raised in a family of 22 children. 11 of these children were foster children. And unlike his siblings, he received a formal education because he was too sickly to work in the family business, which was a tannery. And his older brother interceded for him with his father and appealed to his father to allow John not to go to work in the tannery because he couldn't handle it physically, and instead allow him to come and study at a school that his brother had started. He had devoured books before this time. He had a natural appetite for education. But rather than working in the family business, the tannery business, he was able to get that education. When he first finished college, he was a pastor. He was a pastor at a Baptist church in New York for 5 years. And one of the things, when you read about him, and there are two books. There's a biography about him written by his daughter, Aline, and then there's another book written about his time as regent at the University of Illinois. But he had a very strong sense of duty, and it was probably inculcated in his family upbringing that one of the things that he ought to do is to be a minister. But he struggled with it. It took a toll on his health. It created a lot of stress. And he did it for 5 years. And then at the age of 30, he was invited by his brother to come and teach, and a year later became the principal of a Detroit classical school. At age 38, he became the state superintendent of public instruction in Michigan, and there were 5 men who were assigned the task of starting an educational journal for the state of Michigan. The other 4 quickly dropped out, and it fell to John Milton Gregory to edit that journal and get it off the ground, which he did. At the age of 44, he became president of Kalamazoo College. Kalamazoo College was the first Baptist school established in that western region. And he was president there for 4 or 5 years. So he was involved in really getting that school established. It was very young. At the age of 48, he took the job that, when he looked back on his life, gave him the most personal satisfaction, I think. He was asked to become the first regent of the Illinois Industrial University, a land-grant university that we know as the University of Illinois. While he was regent, though, he'd been very heavily influenced by his own college experience, and it was not uncommon for university presidents at that time to give daily talks. And these were at the University of Illinois, really daily chapel talks. And some of them dealt on spiritual subjects, and others things Gregory taught these young men and women, because under his direction, this was one of the first universities that accepted women, partly because he had a daughter that was very eager for higher education. But he gave daily chapel talks as well as sermons on Sunday, which the students, the daily chapel talks at least, were required to attend. Now, some of you, when you read his story, understand that he's somebody who could sympathize with your struggles. He had difficulties working with his board. One year, while he was on sabbatical in Europe, when he became regent, when he was offered the job, he had a couple of conditions for accepting it. One of those would basically be he had the power to hire the faculty that would serve under him. He thought that was critically important. And the other, that he was a member of the Board of Regents. There were some political changes going on in Illinois. Farmer interests were growing. The Grange movement was pretty strong. And while he was on sabbatical in Europe, the board of the Illinois Industrial University changed the requirements for his position, and he was taken off the board and lost the ability to approve faculty. So he had to deal with boards and troublesome things at times. He also dealt with a lack of money. They didn't have all the money they needed for buildings. They had a year when they had to decrease staff salaries, and they lost faculty as a result. Money was always a struggle for him. So some of the common things that could be difficult in working in the field of education. He also simply had too much work to do. They didn't have enough money to hire all the staff that they needed. So he taught during most of his tenure as regent at that university. He thought fine arts education was very important. And he traveled to Europe. He proposed this to the Board of Regents, and they approved. They allowed him to raise the money, and he traveled to Europe to purchase 400 art objects so he could bring them back, and these sons and daughters of farmers attending this school could learn about fine art from Europe. Much to his chagrin, most of the plaster sculptures that he purchased on his trip arrived in Illinois and in pieces. They were broken in transit. But he worked, and I can't remember if it, I think it was a son-in-law, not a son. He worked with the young man, and they put the plaster sculptures back together so they could put them on display. And that young man who assisted him later became a sculptor himself. So even that was an educational experience. He was one of the first educators who wanted university to offer schools of pedagogy. He thought that was important and that teachers ought to be trained how to teach. Big surprise. He lectured extensively throughout Michigan and Illinois, and his writing on the Seven Laws of Teaching first appeared as a series of articles in that journal in Michigan that I mentioned that he edited. It is really hard to describe just how extensively this book is still being used today. It's used in business fields. It's used in a lot of educational fields. If you have time sometime, just go to Google and type in John Milton Gregory, The Seven Laws of Teaching, and you'll get 2 to 3 pages of people who are applying these laws to various settings, mostly private schools, some public schools. I received a letter this spring from a professor at Saginaw State University in Michigan who is working on a research project right now just to try to define how broadly John Milton Gregory's Seven Laws of Teaching are being used in various fields. And he's also, with some trepidation, hoping to implement these as part of the curriculum in the education department there. And he's a Christian and he knows what he's doing, and he's a little concerned about the reaction that he might get. But yet he recognizes the value of these seven laws for his teachers, and he wants them to be familiar with them. There's an elementary school in Chicago, also named for John Milton Gregory. When he died, he wanted to be buried on the campus at the University of Illinois, and he was. And written on the tombstone, it says, "If you seek his monument, look about you." It's still there today. If I asked you, if I said, take out a piece of paper, and I want you to write a definition. If I asked you, could you define these terms? Teacher, student, teaching, learning, communication, and education. Gregory spends a lot of time on definitions in his book, and he defines all of those terms. I'll turn that back on in a few minutes. Why did he write this book? He explains that from the very beginning, he wanted to set forth in a systematic order the main principles of the art of teaching. Now, is teaching a science or is teaching an art? Gregory uses both terms in his book. When he refers to the science of teaching, he's mostly talking about the study of children and the study of how they develop. He was very much in tune to thinking about kids and thinking about, like Dorothy Sayers did, what is the dominant trait in children of different ages. But when he talks about teaching specifically, he doesn't talk so much about science as he does talk about art. Okay? Let's start at the beginning. Let's start with children that both Gregory and Dorothy Sayers started with. He poses a question at the beginning. How do children differ from adults? What are the differences? And he divides the differences into two main categories. He said, first, the children, they lack size, they lack strength, they lack motor skills. In short, they lack physical development. Okay, that's one way that they're not like adults. Okay, they don't have all those things. In a similar way, children lack knowledge. There's lots of things that they don't know. So what do children need? They need to grow, and they need to learn. And he addressed a different term to that those kinds of development. He said children need to be trained, and children need to be taught. And when he referred to training, he talked about the development of those, the physical development that they needed. The size, strength, motor skills kinds of things. And when that was addressed, he talked about training. When he talked about teaching, when he said the children need to be taught, he was referring to the lack of knowledge that children had. Training and teaching in his mind were different things. Training was the systematic development and cultivation of powers of the mind and body. Teaching is the systematic inculcation of knowledge. Okay, which one, as an educator, are you concerned with? Both. Okay? Teachers are involved in the work of training. And that makes sense to us, especially if we think about the work of elementary teachers. Right? Because those elementary students have a lot further to go than secondary students do. Okay? But we are involved in the work of training. We're also certainly involved in the work of teaching or the sharing of knowledge. We do both. Okay. And if you're familiar with Dorothy Sayers' article, The Lost Tools of Learning, Recovering the Lost Tools of Learning, that division should make some sense to you. When Gregory talks about training, think about the aspect of your work with children that focuses on helping children acquire the tools of learning. Okay. Think of training as the tools of learning. And when you think of teaching, think of your work that involves seeing that the students learn. Okay, so we do both of those things. Gregory said that the proper work of teaching is this: to communicate such knowledge as may be useful in gaining other knowledge, to stimulate in the pupil the love of learning, and to form in him the habits of independent study. Dorothy Sayers wrote this, "For the sole end of education is simply this, to teach men how to learn for themselves, and whatever instruction fails to do this is effort spent in vain." Gregory again, "The proper work of teaching is to communicate such knowledge as may be useful in gaining other knowledge." Sayers, "To teach men how to learn for themselves." I think they're amazingly similar. They both understood that we were to be about teaching children how to learn. Tools of learning are useful in gaining other knowledge. Tools of learning are useful in teaching men how to learn for themselves. Both of them talk about this, and it's something that's important that we not miss. If we don't think about what the applications of that, the danger is we will focus on teaching content, and it'll be really good content, but that's not enough. We cannot, if we're classical educators, neglect teaching children how to learn. Some of that is by example, by helping them go through and successfully learn about a subject. But there are also skills that they need to have. The grammar of basic subjects, skills related to logic, skills related to rhetoric, so that the students will know when they leave our schools how to go about the study of a subject that hasn't been presented to them yet, or how to go beyond what they've received in school. If we forget the importance of teaching the tools of learning, we might teach a lot about English one year, but we might not have asked ourselves, how can we use all of this content in our English class to reinforce what they're learning in the logic class? I read an article in U.S. News and World Report recently about President Reagan's speech written by Peggy Noonan at Pointe du Hoc. It was during a World War II anniversary. And the Army Rangers who had scaled those cliffs were there, and I think it was a dedication of that monument. And the article talked about how Peggy Noonan went about writing that speech. And writing it at first, no one telling her that these men whose deeds were being remembered and honored were going to be present in front of Reagan that day. And she was very young, and she hadn't worked as a speechwriter for him very long, but she knew enough about him that she knew what would happen when he saw those men there and when he delivered that speech. And the article was so interesting because it was a great way to illustrate one way that you could integrate rhetoric and history, how you could reinforce a tool of learning using historical content. That's the kind of thing that we need to be doing. Gregory refers to it as training and teaching. Okay. One note here. Some of Gregory's thoughts reflect the influence of Enlightenment ideals. Those types of statements are most often seen when he talks about the purpose of education. Okay, consider this definition of education and whether you like it or not. Education, in its broadest meaning, embraces all the steps and processes by which an infant is gradually transformed into a full-grown and intelligent man. Education embraces all the steps and processes by which an infant is gradually transformed into a full-grown and intelligent man. Okay, now, depending on exactly what Gregory meant, that statement might or might not be troubling to us. Did he include the work of God's Spirit in the life of a Christian? Isn't that process of sanctification part of growing up? Given his background as a Baptist minister, it wouldn't surprise me that he thought of that, but it doesn't say that. But the value of the seven laws isn't primarily in his statements on the overall purpose of education, but on the art of teaching. That's what I commend this book to you for as teachers. Your understanding of the purposes of education should probably come from other things, from your school goals, from your philosophy statements, from your mission statement, and from your vision statement. Okay? Use Gregory to understand the tools, the principles of the art of teaching. Okay, now why does it matter that Gregory defined training and teaching differently? The development of power and the acquisition of knowledge. Well, it's really important. If we understand those two terms, we can evaluate how we're having the children spend time in our classrooms. We can evaluate how productive we are. Once you've taught, even if you've only taught for a year, you know, you teach that first year, and sometimes those 50-minute periods, you wonder, how am I going to keep kids busy for 50 minutes? Okay. Well, once you've taught a little while, you know, that's not a concern anymore. Okay. You can think of lots of ways to fill the time. But some of them are a lot better than others. And those of you who've taught a long time have another problem. You want the year extended another 2 weeks because you don't have enough time. Or woe if there's an assembly that takes away your class period. Okay? But filling time, that's not the goal, right? That's not good enough. It's not good enough to keep the kids busy. But we need to ask ourselves two questions at the end of that time. One, did the students gain knowledge? Okay, that's teaching. They learned something. Two, did they increase in power? Did they develop the tools of learning? That's training. You know, we could give them worksheet after worksheet after worksheet and keep them busy, but if they're not progressing, we're filling time, but they're not gaining in knowledge. And if we just insist on a rote memorization of facts, but we never talk about understanding, we're not progressing. I'm aware that sometimes we don't give children the full understanding of what they've learned until they get older. We do this with Bible verses with young children because they're so well equipped to memorize. Okay? But having an understanding of training and teaching is useful in evaluating the time that we spend in class and gives us some questions we can ask ourselves. In the first chapter, Gregory makes some foundational arguments and he states some more key definitions. Here's his first primary argument. Teaching has fixed natural laws. Teaching has fixed natural laws. You need to think about that, whether you accept that or not, because that is the premise of his entire book, I think. Gregory argues that in each successful lesson, there are seven elements. And it doesn't matter if the lesson's short or if the lesson is long. It doesn't matter if we're talking about elementary students or secondary students. He says those seven elements are always present and that they must be attended to. He writes, teaching is a process in which definite forces are employed to produce definite effects, and these effects follow their causes as regularly and certainly as the day follows the sun. What the teacher does, he does through natural agencies working out their natural effects. Causation is as certain, if not always as clear, in the movements of the mind as in the motions of matter. How can you test his hypothesis? Observe teachers. It had to be what he did. Observe teachers. Find successful teachers. Observe teachers in whose classroom you think the students are really learning. The best teachers on your staff. Ask yourself if there are common elements that are always present. I mean, he's given you seven. Test them. If a lesson's not going well, see if you can identify one of those seven elements that wasn't addressed as well as it ought to have been. It's a hypothesis that you can test. Remember that by success, Gregory is arguing for both teaching and training. If we accept this premise, that teaching has fixed natural laws, the rest of his argument follows. That is, if we can discover these laws, certainly we can apply them and use them to achieve our purpose. But he makes his case even stronger. Successful teachers must. They're not optional. Successful teachers must follow these laws. He said, he who would teach a child successfully must follow the laws of teaching. These laws are not optional. They are inherent in every successful lesson. Now, he has an interesting It's not much of a tangent, but a side note, I guess. And he talks about master teachers. Okay, now what about these individuals who have never read, heard of, apparently had a need to study and try to figure out how to apply something like the seven laws of teaching, but there is no argument they are outstanding teachers. Okay, what about these people that we call master teachers? Okay, they're not abundant. You probably know them almost certainly when you see them or when you've had the pleasure of being a student in the classroom. Okay, do these laws apply to the master teachers? Gregory says that master teachers are master teachers because of how well they can implement the first three laws. What are those three characteristics? Number one, they know their subject extremely well. They're the kind of person who's not intimidated by questions that students ask. They enjoy the questions that students ask and can almost always answer them. Unlike many of us, including myself, the first years of teaching American history, a subject that I thought I knew, hearing myself say, I don't know, but I'll find out. Okay, there are lots of those times when we're starting out teaching. Master teachers, boy, they just really know their subject. That's the first thing that makes them a master teacher. The second thing is, they teach in such a way that they create interest in their students. I mean, their students are attentive. And it follows from the first. And it follows from their ability to communicate. I remember early in my years at Logos, when I was first aware of a high school junior asking her parents for a leather-bound copy of the Iliad and the Odyssey for Christmas. I didn't have a classical education. And that made an impression on me. Okay? Why did that child do that? Because her classical literature teacher was a master teacher. He knew his subject well, he could communicate it very well, and he had inspired a similar beginning of affections for the subject that he himself had. So she wanted those books. That's what she wanted for Christmas. And that's wonderful. They know their subject well, they can create interest in their students, and they are superb communicators. Okay, so master teachers are master teachers, Gregory says, because of how well they apply the first three laws. Another foundational definition, what is teaching? Earlier we said Gregory wrote that teaching is the systematic inculcation of knowledge. He refines that definition now to say teaching is the communication of knowledge, but we need to be attentive to how he defines communication, what he means. Communication is not the cut and paste function of a word processing program. It doesn't work. That is not his definition of communication. Communication is not transmission of a mental something from one person to another, but communication is the sense of helping another reproduce that same knowledge so that both of them understand it. There's something that has to happen in the mind of the person who is learning, if we're to say, according to Gregory's definition, that communication has taken place. The learner has to develop his own conception. He has to reproduce it in his own mind. Remember, these laws are essential to each complete act of teaching. None can be omitted. Nothing can be added. Okay. You should. The handouts have gone around. You should all have a handout. Hope. In his book, then at this point, he states each of these laws. Okay? One, a teacher must be one who knows the lesson or truth to be taught. Okay, remember that phrase about art was added in the later version. Two, a learner is one who attends with interest to the lesson given. Three, the language used as a medium between teacher and learner must be common to both. Okay, those are the domain of the master teacher. Four, the lesson to be learned must be explicable in the terms of the truth already known by the learner. The unknown must be explained by means of the known. Five, teaching is arousing and using the pupil's mind to form in it a desired conception or thought. 6, learning is thinking into one's own understanding, a new idea or truth, or working into habit a new art or skill. 7, the test and proof of teaching done, the finishing and fastening process, must be reviewing, rethinking, renewing, and reproducing of the knowledge taught. And what I want to do is focus on those last three laws. 6 is different. 6 is learning is thinking into one's own understanding a new idea or truth, period. Okay. Right after he writes these laws, he rewrites each law as a rule. Okay, now imagine some of you might be getting ready to teach your first year. Okay, and you're trying to figure out, what do I do? Okay? And a lot of what you do is going to be based on your experience as a student. You've been a desired conception or thought. 6, learning is thinking into one's own understanding, a new idea or truth, or working into habit a new art or skill. 7, the test and proof of teaching done, the finishing and fastening process, must be reviewing, rethinking, renewing, and reproducing of the knowledge taught. And what I want to do is focus on those last three laws. 6 is different. 6 is learning is thinking into one's own understanding a new idea or truth, period. Okay. Right after he writes these laws, he rewrites each law as a rule. Okay, now imagine some of you might be getting ready to teach your first year. Okay, and you're trying to figure out, what do I do? Okay? And a lot of what you do is going to be based on your experience as a student. You've been a student a long time. You've had a lot of different teachers. And you're probably going to follow the example of some of the teachers that you've had recently. But here's a list that's very helpful, might be a little bit intimidating for you to use as you try to figure out, what in the world am I supposed to be doing? Okay? And he restates the laws. 1, know thoroughly and familiarly the lesson you wish to teach. Or in other words, teach from a full mind and clear understanding. Well, let's be honest about first year teaching. Sometimes you're a day ahead of the kids. Right? That's how it goes. That's part of first year teacher syndrome. Okay? G.K. Chesterton said, anything worth doing is worth doing badly. I really upset an administrator when he saw that phrase in my office one day. He said, you're a Christian, you're supposed to be striving to do things really well. Well, I am. But sometimes this is the best I can do. It's not a comfortable feeling. So here's my advice to you. Be realistic. You know, we think when we graduate from college that we really know our subject. Or on the elementary side, those who are parents probably do, but we think we really know children. But we have a lot to learn when we start. Okay? That's okay. Be organized. Be really well organized. Because you want to get better your second year. You have a lot to learn. Okay? Start the task. If you're organized, what you do the first year, you can improve the second year. If you're organized, then you can make improvements the third year. Okay? If you're not organized, then what you did the first year, you know, when you taught that really good lesson, that 1 out of 5 that you felt like, yes, something clicked, I'm not sure why it did, but that day went really well. You've got to write those things down so you don't forget it when you come to that point the following year. Okay? Be organized. 2, the second rule, gain and keep the attention and interest of the pupils upon the lesson. Refuse. He's very clear here. Refuse to teach without attention. You come up to the front of the room, the kids are talking in the back, don't you start teaching. Okay? If you don't have their attention at the beginning of the period, the rest of the period is going to be a struggle and you're probably going to lose. Okay? You lose the kids partway through, they turn to the neighbor, they talk to each other, their eyes are looking out the window, daydreaming, you don't have their attention. Look at what Gregory says. Refuse to teach without attention. Okay? Now, if you need to use some form of discipline to get their attention, do it. By all means. Sit up straight. Eyes to the front. Stop talking to your neighbor. Move to that desk. Whatever you need to do, get their attention. As you get better, and the lessons get more interesting, you'll need less discipline because they'll be more attentive because they're more interested. But don't teach unless you have their attention. Use words understood by both pupil and teacher in the same sense. Language clear and vivid, alike to both. You're a new teacher. How do you know what your kid's vocabulary is and where it differs from yours? Have them read out loud to you. They'll stop at words that are unfamiliar and that they can't pronounce. Okay? That'll start to give you a sense of where their vocabulary is. Okay? And that will make you more aware of what vocabulary you need to use so you can use vocabulary that's understood and know when you're teaching them new words, which you should do. 4, begin with what is already well known to the pupil in the lesson upon the subject and proceed to the unknown by small, easy, or natural steps, letting the known explain the unknown. One of the challenges when we begin teaching, we have to figure out what the kids know. Go talk to the teacher they had last year. Okay? Ask them what they taught in math. Present a lesson to them, say, I'm going to teach this week. Is this something that the kids should know already? Test them before you start with a small quiz. You're going to start a unit. You don't want to go too far. You don't want to bore them with repetition that doesn't move forward. 5, use the pupil's mind, exciting his self-activities. Keep his thoughts as much as possible ahead of your expression. Make him a discoverer of the truth. 6, require the pupil to reproduce in thought the lesson he is learning, thinking it out in its parts, proofs, connections, and applications till he can express it in his own language. 7, review. Reproducing correctly the old, deepening its impression with new thought, correcting false views, and completing the truth. So if you're a new teacher, you're not sure what to do, there's a great list. Okay? You won't understand in every case how to do those things, but that's what you want to do. Now there's one thing, those things aren't hard to understand. Okay? They're pretty straightforward. But they're hard to do when you first start out. Don't let that list discourage you. What I tell my teachers when I work with new teachers is, look at that list. Where do you feel like you've got the most work to do? Let's pick one, let's pick two. Let's work on those. I know there's some others that you're not feeling so great about. Be patient. Okay? Let's start to get better. Let's try and work on one area, and when we've worked on one area and we've brought that level up, then we'll pick a second. Keep working to improve. Don't get discouraged. The first year of teaching is challenging. I want to see my teachers making progress over 2 or 3 years' time. Okay, I don't know typically at the end of the first year what kind of a teacher I've got completely if they haven't taught before. Okay, I want to see them making progress. But I'm really looking that second year, and especially that third. Okay. So be patient. These things can be overwhelming if you're busy. I want to move now to the fifth law of teaching. There's two laws, the first law and the fifth law, that address teachers. The first one talks about the qualification of a teacher, but I want to talk about the fifth one that defines the function of the teacher. I find that new teachers need a clear conception of their work, and I like to start discussion of this book with this law. You know, otherwise, we'll imitate what we had recently, and if we're talking about a young first-year teacher, then we're talking about a college teacher. Okay, there's a reason why the lecture method works best in college settings. But the kids are different in junior high and high school or elementary school. And so that model may be very appropriate for that setting, but it's not the one we want to imitate in this new setting. Okay? The foundational law is the fifth law of teaching. We start with this because it'll focus us on our primary goal. Gregory defines for us our primary purpose. The description that he offers us in this chapter defines the role of the teacher by the results. The first law is about qualification. This law focuses on results. What are we trying to do? What do we want to see in the students? The goal is the awakening and setting into action the learner's mind. The arousing of his self-activities, as they have been called. Those faculties of cognition, imagination, and reasoning, whose action must always, and get this, be voluntary and self-impelled. Okay? I want to awaken his mind. I want to arouse his self-activities. I want him to learn voluntarily and be self-impelled. Okay? Now, if we're teaching young elementary students, they're like that already. Okay? We just don't want to turn that switch off. Okay? But we all want to do that. When we step into our classrooms, when we plan our lessons, our goal is to arouse the student's mind and cause him to think. We want our kids thinking, we want them reasoning, we want them using their imagination. Think of this as you think about what it is you're going to teach. You can't just think about the what. You have to think about how can I use this or present this in such a way that I wake my kids up. Gregory says, all telling, explaining, or other acts of so-called teaching are useless, except as they serve to excite and direct the pupil's voluntary mental powers. Consider that statement, useless. Okay, you have to create interest and a desire in your students to learn. Cognition, imagination, reason must be voluntary and self-impelled. The law is specifically stated this way, excite and direct the self-activities of the learner and tell him nothing that he can learn himself. Well, how do we go about accomplishing this? I want to share with you in a moment how Japanese math teachers do it, but I want to note that Gregory makes two exceptions to this rule about not telling students something that they can learn for themselves. One exception is we need to save time. Okay? You're thinking about all you have to teach. You know, teachers, especially at secondary, use the lecture method because they can cover a lot of material in a short amount of time. Okay? And there might be times when that's appropriate, but they should be the exception, not the rule. Okay, so why do we tell kids things they can learn for themselves? To save time. But it's an exception. Second, we don't want kids to get discouraged. Okay, we presented a lesson, we've got the kids working, but they're not getting it. And they're working at it. Cheerful attitude, working hard, trying to understand, it's not coming. Other kids in the class are getting it. We don't want them to get discouraged. So we help them along a little bit. Gregory poses an interesting question in this chapter. We know kids learn without teachers. And we know kids learn outside of schools. Why do we need teachers in schools in the first place? Okay? Think about it. It'll help us form a correct understanding of our role as a teacher. There are two reasons. One, knowledge is scattered. And if we know our subject the way that we ought to, we should know what is worth knowing about that area. We can save the students time by pointing them toward things that are worth studying and away from things that are not so important. One, we need schools and we need teachers because knowledge is scattered. It's also going to take them...